From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now. Tensions between the U.S. and China just went up. After days of speculation, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi landed in Taiwan this morning, U.S. time. She is the first House Speaker to visit the self-governing democracy in 25 years. To welcome her, Taiwan's tallest building lit up with the words, Taiwan Heart USA and Speaker Pelosi. But what was Beijing's reaction? Let's talk now to NPR correspondent Emily Feng. Emily, hello.
Hey, Scott.
So the Washington Post just posted an opinion piece from Pelosi, and I'm going to read a little bit. It says, quote, in the face of the Chinese Communist Party's accelerating aggression, our congressional delegation's visit should be seen as an unequivocal statement that America stands with Taiwan, our democratic partner, as it defends itself and its freedom, end quote. Tell us a little bit more about the message she's sending to the world and to China.
She's sending the message that the U.S. stands by Taiwan. And you've seen this not just from Pelosi, but from other congressional leaders who have sent stronger signals that they want relations with Taiwan to be more significant. They've pushed for Taiwan to be present at multilateral institutions like the World Health Organization during the global coronavirus pandemic. All of this is stuff China opposes because China does not believe Taiwan is a country. China believes Taiwan is a province of China. And so it opposes Pelosi's visits. And it's also opposed all of these closening of ties between the U.S. and China. The U.S. has said this is not an escalation. This is simply consistent with U.S. policy towards Taiwan and China. But this whole visit is about a clash of perceptions. China's perception of Pelosi's visit is that this is an escalation and that they worry this will pave the way for more U.S. leaders to visit Taiwan.
And as far as this escalation as Beijing sees it, what do we know about Beijing's response? We have seen reports of Chinese military drills around Taiwan.
It's been extremely strong. They've used every channel they have so far, short of actual kinetic military action, to react against the visit. So diplomatically, they've said they will, quote, not sit idly by if Pelosi visits. The military launched these live-fire military drills in literally all directions around the island of Taiwan minutes after Pelosi lands. So there are now joint air and sea exercises going on to the north, south, east, and west of Taiwan as Pelosi's in Taipei. The worry is that China might escalate further, that it could, for example, fire missile tests in the direction of Taiwan. This has been done before in 1995 and 1996 during what's now called the Third Taiwan Strait Crisis. China has not done this so far. But the concern is that China's Xi Jinping could decide to signal some strong military aggression short of actual war and escalate the situation further, in which case Taiwan would have to respond and the U.S. might as well.
Yeah. And the analysts tell us, of course, as far as Xi Jinping and his messaging, that he faces a critical political meeting in the next few months and perhaps needs to project strength on behalf of China. Now, the U.S. and China are, of course, on opposite sides in Ukraine, with China backing Russia's aggression. What are the implications of confronting Russia and confronting China at the same time?
It would be a lot for the U.S. to do, but the hope is, with Pelosi's visit, that the U.S. projects such a strong show of ties with Taiwan that China would be dissuaded to try anything similar to what Russia has done with Ukraine. The hope is that China sees Pelosi's visit as a gesture of support and might delay or change any potential plans to invade the island, which is something that China's leaders have mentioned directly in speeches before. They've made no qualms about the fact that they one day hope to retake the island and make it part of China. The risk is that by messaging strong U.S. ties, that could actually provoke an insecure Beijing into doing something a bit more aggressive militarily towards Taiwan. So it's a fine line for both the U.S. and for China. Neither country has signaled that they want any kind of open military conflict. But ironically, just like a game of chicken, they also have to signal that they're willing to go to war in order to dissuade the other from making the first move.
So it sounds like there's uncertainty as to where this goes from here. On one hand, each side can have these scripted speeches and scripted statements, but as the Chinese president has made no secret of his wish for what he calls reunification and increasingly support for Taiwan coming out of Washington, D.C., it seems like where this goes from here is uncertain.
The next step is in China's hands. Xi Jinping has to decide whether or not he escalates. Right now, there are military drills, but again, he could decide to up those with missile tests. Then again, it's a sensitive time. His economy is not doing well. He has that big political meeting you mentioned coming up in October, which he doesn't want to mess up with a botched military drill or potential attack on Taiwan. And he certainly doesn't want worse relations with the U.S. on top of that.
That's NPR's Emily Feng in Beijing. Emily, thank you again.
Thanks, Scott.
Well, with the midterm elections just 3 months away here in the U.S., President Biden is trying to turn the page on lousy poll numbers by touting some wins. He's on the verge of a legislative victory now that Senator Joe Manchin says he'll support a climate and health care bill. And last night, Biden announced the targeted killing of al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri.
And 1 week ago, after being advised that the conditions were optimal, I gave the final approval to go get him. And the mission was a success. None of his family members were hurt, and there were no civilian casualties.
But past presidencies show it's not easy for a White House to sell victories to a public anxious about the economy. Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. He helps us look at the news through an historical lens. Julian, al-Zawahiri first. He was Osama bin Laden's right-hand man. Biden was vice president when Obama announced bin Laden's killing. Al-Zawahiri became number one. Now he's gone. President Trump ordered the killing of ISIS leader Abu Bakr Baghdadi, and it didn't seem to enhance his presidency. Now, we're going to talk elsewhere about the importance of these targeted deaths for security, but will al-Zawahiri's death bring a beleaguered Biden goodwill from voters?
It's not clear. I think part of what presidents learn is that even major success, either on domestic policy or something of this sort on foreign policy, which is a major development, doesn't always translate to voters. Even if they are happy with what has happened, are comforted by the development, it doesn't change how they're going to vote, especially in troubled economic times.
Well, especially now when we're hearing from some of the 9/11 families that actually they're still focused on, you know, Biden's trip to Saudi Arabia, you know, because the attack on 9/11 was Saudi, a terrorist. Well, to legislation. Democrats and Republicans passed legislation to invest $280 billion in semiconductors and science research. Senator Joe Manchin signed off on the deal to lower drug prices and confront climate change. Now, your opinion piece for CNN was headlined, "Biden's on the verge of a huge legislative victory." But most headlines read like this one in the New York Times: Biden savors much-needed victories, but will highs overshadow lows? Your thoughts about it?
Well, both can be true. I mean, in the history of American politics, often you can have very big moments of legislative success, sometimes success that's transformative in terms of what the American government does. But especially in midterms, it doesn't mean it's going to bring you success for your party. And very often the two don't mesh. In fact, they can move in opposite directions. The more success you have sometimes only stimulates and energizes your opposition. So I think both headlines might actually be true.
You point to LBJ.
Well, LBJ, between 1964 and 66, moved through Congress the Great Society, really one of the biggest moments of legislating, from Medicare and Medicaid to federal education support. But the 66 midterms saw an increase in Republicans in the House and a strengthening of the conservative coalition with conservative Democrats. So he wasn't feeling good. Inflation, deficits, and the beginning of Vietnam were on the minds of voters in 66, despite all his success.
I also think of Jimmy Carter, who feverishly worked to free American hostages in Iran, even as his successor Ronald Reagan was being sworn in. But then you say there's a parallel now to what happened to Reagan's Republicans during his first midterm.
Yeah, I mean, Reagan passed through Congress a historic tax cut, the embodiment of supply-side economics, which for conservatives was a great victory in 1981. He moves a lot of deregulation through executive power. But in 82, House Democrats increase their numbers. They do very well. Why? Because they say there is a Reagan recession, which there was. And not only was the recession causing voters to move away from Republicans in the House, but it undercut the victory because Democrats said the tax cuts actually exacerbated the economic problems.
Yeah. Well, and now you have the Biden administration trying to get out some of the good news about the economy. You know, the jobless numbers are way down, things like that, even though people are talking about a recession. You've got Fox News hammering gas prices, even though they're following, hammering crime, although that's fallen too. Can you point to something in the few seconds we have we could learn from past presidents about getting a message out?
Well, look, Obama went through this as well. Didn't help in the midterms, but he got the message out by 2012. And he showed the difference between himself and the GOP, and that led to re-election.
Yeah. Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton, taking a look at where the Biden administration is right now ahead of those midterms, which are just a few days away. Julian, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
A church is a church is a church, right? Well, now a think tank seems to qualify, too. The Family Research Council is a conservative think tank. It's led by Tony Perkins. It was founded in the early 80s and has long opposed abortion and same-sex marriage. And now, at least in the eyes of the IRS, it is a church. And it's just the latest group on the political right to earn that tax status. To explain the implications of this, let's talk to Andrea Suazo. She broke the story for ProPublica. Hi, Andrea.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. So the Family Research Council is active on political issues, opposing same-sex marriage, opposing abortion. How did it make its case to the IRS that it's a church?
So according to the Family Research Council's website, they are a nonprofit research and educational organization. They've been a nonprofit for several decades. However, in 2020, they applied to the IRS to get a status change to an association of churches, saying that their religious organization, Tony Perkins, is an ordained minister in the Southern Baptist mm-hmm. Church, that several other of their leaders are also ordained ministers, and that they have this network of partner churches to whom they disseminate information, for whom they put on events. And so they sort of made this argument that they fit about 11 of the 14 bullet points that the IRS uses to determine what is a church.
And what are the benefits to the Family Research Council for getting this tax designation as an association of churches?
A nonprofit, more generally, which they have been, has a number of tax benefits. Churches are automatically in that category, but they additionally do not file the financial disclosures that all other charities are required to file, commonly referred to as the Form 990, and it tells you what salaries they're paying top employees, who their board members are, what independent contractors they're paying, what their top line financials are, and churches do not have to do that.
Oh, okay. And so what is the upshot of this? It is now going to be less transparent in future tax years for persons who are religious church organization watchdogs. What do they worry about now that we're going to get a lot less information out of this group?
The folks I spoke to did have some concerns about this loss of information. You know, they can continue to file their Form 990, but they don't necessarily have to because of their status. There are some protections that church-like organizations get. They can sort of make the case for exemptions to hiring discrimination laws kind of based on church status. And I think there are some concerns about organizations applying for the status change for these benefits without necessarily actually resembling what one might think of as a church.
Yeah, what did you learn about the Family Research Council? Does it say hold worship services?
So one of the questions on their application is specifically about worship services, and they do say that they hold regular services that are attended by an average of more than 65 people. They also sort of make clear that these services are kind of focused towards their employees. I did call the organization and ask about church services, and the person who answered was told me that the organization does not have church services.
Yeah, it certainly appears to be a little fishy. But you report that this is not an isolated incident for these conservative
church-related cultural groups. Have other organizations done the same thing?
I found a wave of organizations that did appear to be doing this. The Billy Graham Evangelistic Association switched in kind of the mid-2010s. Focus on the Family, which is based in Colorado, switched in 2016. Liberty Council, which is a legal nonprofit, switched in 2018. These are specifically religious organizations. They are Christian organizations, but they also are doing things that don't necessarily resemble what you would think of a church typically doing. They're doing lawsuits and they are issuing policy papers. They're doing a lot of advocacy. Family Research Council did not comment for me on this story, but Focus on the Family and Liberty Council both did and told me that they had always been operating as a church, and so this just reflected that status. And Focus on the Family said they just really wanted to protect their donor information.
So is anyone concerned about this? I mean, these are, for tax purposes, church organizations, but kind of on their face, they don't appear to be your garden variety neighborhood church. Who's worried about this?
Some of the experts I spoke to certainly had concerns about this and concerns about the IRS's ability to kind of regulate this. In response to the story, I have recently learned that a group of congresspeople are sending a letter to the IRS asking them to look at the Family Research Council's status and asking if there is any additional regulatory guidance that the IRS needs in order to adequately reinforce the rules surrounding nonprofits and churches. Mm.
That's Andrea Suazo, reporter with ProPublica. Andrea, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you very much.
Well, to North Carolina now, which has been described as the new Napa Valley of oysters. But something is killing oysters along the Atlantic coast this summer, and a team of researchers has come together to investigate. Zachary Turner visited one of the team's sample sites and reported this story from member station WUNC.
Drive along the waters of Carteret County in North Carolina, and you'll be sure to encounter a stand of wooden pylons that signal a nearby oyster farm. Oyster farming is a large and growing industry in the state. Farms produced $5 million worth of oysters in 2020, compared to $500,000 in 1994. But something, or some combination of things, is killing Carolina oysters.
On the biological end, what it looks like is oysters starving.
That's Tal Ben-Hareen, an assistant professor at the College of Veterinary Medicine at North Carolina State University. He's studying ongoing summer mortality events that plague oyster farms along the Atlantic coast.
We see oysters that are healthy one day or seemingly healthy one day and dying in mass the next. And when you look at, say, live oysters sampled during this mortality event, they seem to be withering away, not always, but withering away. They're watery. The visceral mass, which is like the meaty bit of tissue, seems to kind of implode within itself.
These deaths have occurred in oyster farms sporadically over the last 10 years. Ben-Hareen and his team deployed 6 field sites in North Carolina, where Callie Simpson, a graduate research assistant, and Christian Gillikin, an undergraduate summer research fellow, count oysters on the deck of their research vessel.
So that's a dead one.
That's a dead one?
Yeah, it's like opened up.
Yeah.
And then some of them, they kind of tried to disguise themselves, I guess, as being alive.
So you can just mistake it, but you'll hear the hollow shell compared to the full shell.
Once they sort out the dead oysters, the team measures the shells. Jonathan Lucas, a research associate with the pathology lab at North Carolina State University, explains what they hope to learn from the numbers.
You could have sublethal effects, meaning that they're not dying, but they're also not growing. You know, and then also, if we see an actual like a decrease in length, that's not because the oysters are shrinking. What that means is we're seeing selection for size.
This site hasn't yet had a big die-off, but others have not been so lucky, with 80% of the oysters dying at least one site.
If we can find the smoking gun, figure out exactly what has caused the mortality event, that would be a success.
Once Lucas and the team finish at the field site, they bring samples back to Mark Krzyzewski, a graduate student at the Noble Lab at UNC's Institute of Marine Sciences.
Rather than just looking at the oyster and the physiology and the responses that the oyster have, we want to know whether they be bacterial or parasitic protozoans, what the presence of those pathogens actually looks like and how that may be overwhelming the oyster
The ocean is filled with bacteria, protozoa, viruses, and much more. Every microscopic passenger in the water column flows through the local oyster population and filters through their gills. When an oyster becomes stressed, its relationship with these microorganisms can change.
It's been very hot and very salty this summer, so that offers additional challenges to oysters, which may prevent them from being able to stave off some of the challenges from the microbial populations.
Chris Mateo, president of North Carolina Shellfish Growers Association, owns two farms and sells oyster seed from his nursery. This helps mitigate the losses he sustained from a mortality event that recently struck one of his grow sites.
It's a total collapse. In some cases, 90% of people's crops are decimated inside of a couple of weeks. This one, we're getting reports anywhere from 60 to 90% of people's crops essentially dying rather quickly.
When oysters die, farmers lose more than just money.
Oyster farming is a year-round, it's a year-round effort. So when you have a collapse like this, people have so much time and effort in their crop, and they're banking on selling that crop. So there's a financial collapse that occurs, and the workload to deal with the mortality and the extra work involved in separating live oysters from dead oysters.
Jonathan Lucas and the other scientists associated with the project are quick to acknowledge that this research would not be possible without the collaboration of industry stakeholders.
It's a win-win, I think. You know, it's a win for the grower because he gets to help out with research that hopefully helps his industry succeed and do better and solve some problems that might be coming up. And it's a good deal for us because we get to conduct experiments and ask scientific questions.
Despite the severity of these summer mortality events, Mateo, the oyster farmer, emphasizes that consumers do not need to avoid oyster products. For farmers who salvage a portion of their crop, there is no evidence that the surviving oysters pose a risk to human health. For Here and Now, I'm Zachary Turner.
In Louisiana, some people fish with their arms. Yeah, they stick their arms into murky water to feel around for catfish. And if they're lucky, they grab one by the mouth. It's called noodling. And a new law making noodling legal just took effect yesterday. From member station WWNO in New Orleans, Kezia Setiawan goes to a lake to learn how it's done.
On a scorching July day on Louisiana's Caney Lake, two friends are waist-deep in the shallow water. Another on a small motorboat. One of them, Eli Spangler, wears snorkeling goggles. He dives under and sticks his hand in an old tire, grabbing at blue catfish with his bare hands.
Almost. I almost had it, bro.
No catch this time. One of his buddies, John Robert Blake, says it's all about technique.
You put one finger behind his gill, and that'll open his mouth up, and then just lock your fingers like this. And then when you get him locked, do the same thing to the other side, and he ain't going nowhere.
Eli catches his breath, secures the goggles on his face, and dives back in the water. John Robert has the net ready. His brother Rhett holds the boat to make sure it doesn't float off too far away.
That's what I'm talking about, baby!
This is the first time Eli has caught a catfish with his bare hands. He usually just acts as support.
We're always doing this together. I just have never grabbed one before.
A couple of years ago, these guys taught another friend how to noodle. He then taught his dad, who happened to be a state representative, Jack McFarland.
And I think part of it initially was just that, man, I can't let my son show me up. I got to do this.
At the time, none of that was legal. So this year, McFarland introduced a bill to change that.
So look, let's just go ahead and define it as legal and everyone can enjoy the sport.
That makes Louisiana the 17th state to legalize noodling. Most are in the South. Back at Caney Lake, Eli Spangler says that they're happy McFarland pushed for its legalization.
I'm sure that he just felt like it was the right thing to do.
They've been noodling for over 5 years now, sinking their own plywood boxes and even a bathtub to encourage catfish to spawn. Eli is pretty excited he finally caught one today.
But when I went in there that first time today and just reached my arm in there and came up with a catfish, it was just like, it was like it all paid off. It was like everything that I thought it was going to be, it was.
The Blake brothers say once you try it out, you'll be hooked.
Yeah, if you had never done it before, you need to get in with some people and do it.
Absolutely.
You need to go because it is an experience of a lifetime. It is fun.
It is. It is very
fun. You want to do it twice if you do it once. I guarantee you.
It's addicting. I would say it's addicting. Of course, we are a little crazy. We like to do crazy things.
John Roberts says it's been a good haul today at Caney Lake this late into the season, with a total of 4 catfish clocking in at almost 26 pounds. Better than previous outings.
The last 2 times I've been, I had caught a fish, so we already do it 2 times better than what I've been doing.
And there's a payoff, fried catfish tonight.
Yeah, we'll eat it.
While now it's the end of the season, with noodling now legal in the state, Rhett, John Roberts, and Eli can't wait for next year. For NPR News, I'm Kezia Sitalan in Chatham, Louisiana.
As Russia's war on Ukraine enters its 6th month, new information has been uncovered about how it's financing the war and also surviving Western sanctions. It's a story that includes treasure, corruption, coercion, cookies, we'll explain, and exploitation. And it was recently unearthed through the work of CNN reporter Nima El-Baghir. The quick version, Russia has been illegally smuggling gold, billions of dollars worth, from Sudan, skirting Sudanese laws and helping to impoverish this sub-Saharan African nation. In return, Sudan gets Russian support, including arms, in crushing the pro-democracy movement. Nima El-Baghir is CNN's chief international investigative correspondent. She joins us now. Nima, welcome.
Thank you.
Incredibly gripping reporting. We watch as you walk up to armed guards who do not want you finding these Russian operations. But start at the beginning. In your first report, you say you uncovered the extent of Russia's grip on Sudan. How did Russia get into the Sudanese gold industry? This didn't, you know, start with the war in Ukraine. So tell us how it began.
No, absolutely. And I think therein really lies the broader net of complicity that stretches beyond Russia, right? It stretches to the United States and an international community that has watched this happen in slow motion for years. It began after Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014, where President Putin was very vocal about the fact that he was going to create Fortress Russia, i.e. buttress the Russian economy from any potential sanctions that would come down the pipeline. Mm. And by 2017, they then began offering these lifelines to autocrats across the continent. Sudanese former dictator President Omar al-Bashir was one of those who jumped at the chance to get into business with Russia. And Russian companies came in, including the notorious Wagner private military contractor group, which is sanctioned by the United States. Yevgeny Prigozhin, the owner, is accused of meddling in U.S. elections and also for exploiting Sudan's natural resources. And so they came in, and they came in so heavily, and it was so apparent for the world to see. And the U.S. actually sanctioned them in 2020 during the Trump administration. So the expectation was always that they would amplify their sanctions evasion activities in the build-up to the Ukraine war. And that was what we began hearing from our sources.
Right.
In fact, much of this really began reaching a crescendo after the Ukraine war in February, because what the Russians needed was a sanctions evasion mechanism. And I am not a legal scholar, so this was... I and the team, regularly had migraines because it is so serpentine and it is so clever the way that they have used these front companies.
Yeah, it's amazing. And we just say President Omar al-Bashir was toppled by the pro-democracy movement that's now being threatened. This group called Wagner, the Russian group, is now working with a Sudanese general in this quid pro quo. You know, the Sudanese get weaponry and training and helped install a sort of a new anti-democracy government. The Russians get the gold, which initially, in your writing, it's astonishing. They said was cookies that they were flying out, you know, and so they had boxes of cookies on these Russian planes, but underneath the gold. Now, you drove deep into the desert that we see miles and miles of yellow sand. And by the way, we'll hook people up to your reporting. But as far as the eye can see, you can't hide as you drive across the desert and come across this Russian-owned gold mining facility
You see a red Soviet era hammer and sickle flag, mm-hmm. That's a clue. It's a Russian operation.
Yes.
And let's listen to what you see next.
We get to the entrance and decide to ask a few questions, but not before we turn on our covert cameras.
Dia Hasherika Russia?
Hi.
Well, that's convenient. They've just confirmed the Russians are at this location.
There's a black pickup approaching. Okay, tamam. Guards just confirmed that the Russian manager's in that black pickup and is on his way to us.
A Russian van races to the office, but no one seems to be coming over. But others turn up instead.
Who turned up?
Sudanese security guards who were very insistent that despite what the initial guard had told us, that there were Russians at the location, a fact that we had already cross-referenced with coordinates and satellite imagery, that this was the location that has always been associated with Russia's processing of Sudanese gold, that we were somehow mistaken that it was the Sudanese company Al Solaj, and we were able to obtain through our sources the company registration documents for Al Solaj and see in black and white the fact that a transfer of holdings had happened from the Wagner, the Russian-owned company, Meadowy Gold, to Al Solaj. And it's a very, they were so clever, but often in these moments, there's always that little bit of stupidity that gives you away. Mm-hmm. And in this instance, it's that under Sudanese law, once you transfer holdings, you also transfer legal liabilities. We were able to put these documents side by side, and you could see that the companies had the exact same judgments in Sudanese employment courts against them,
yeah,
stretching all the way back to 2019.
Look, you interviewed a whistleblower who's been in hiding for 9 months under threat of assassination. He told you he thought Russia was responsible for the death of democracy in Sudan. We spoke about the current government putting down this pro-democracy movement. Mm-hmm. Russia getting billions of dollars in Sudanese gold and in return giving the Sudanese means to fight their own people. We can assume the man you interviewed isn't the only whistleblower who's been targeted or killed. This is dangerous business.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think what we tried to do with the piece, and I hope your listeners take away from this conversation, is that Russia is spilling blood on the battlefields of Ukraine, but it's also spilling blood in Sudan.
Yeah.
You know, the suppression of the pro-democracy movement is because of Russia's support of the generals. And it is being allowed to happen on the world's watch. And it is not in America's interest for Russia to continue to evade U.S. sanctions. And the State Department really didn't have that great an answer for us. I mean, Rear Admiral John Kirby was on New Day, was on CNN on Monday. And he said, well, this shows that sanctions are biting. Yes, he's right. It does. It also shows that they're finding a way around sanctions.
Right. And people are being hurt because of that. We mentioned whistleblowers under threat. You got word that there were credible threats against you. We're reading Sudan's military authorities have launched a manhunt for people suspected of providing information to you. That's, you know, kind of chilling right there. But there's also been reaction from the people to your investigation. Talk about these massive protests.
Within hours of our broadcast, there had already been a call for, there was a demonstration scheduled for the Saturday, but then there was a call for a demonstration to be scheduled for July 31st. And local Sudanese legal defense funds, the Sudan Emergency Lawyers Group, the next day, they said that this was a noticeable spike in repression, that the generals were so clearly scared that they were fighting these protesters, unarmed protesters, with chemical solutions and noxious tear gas. And I think that's something that, I'm from Sudan, but something that for me was so heartbreaking and moving and inspiring in equal measure is that it is Sudanese that are ringing the alarm bells. You know, the whistleblower who was in hiding for 9 months, they targeted his family. They harassed his wife in front of you know, small children. The others that we have spoken to are suspected of speaking to us. And yet, all our sources took these risks to provide these documents because they believe that this is not just something that will impact Sudan, that those dying in the battlefields of Ukraine also deserve the world to know what Russia is doing and to have Russia's pipeline in some way curtailed before more people are hurt and more people die.
Well, you're acknowledging those people on the ground in Khartoum, but we must again acknowledge you and your crew driving up to these thugs, really, which is what the Russian group is. But we have less than a minute. Do you think there will be any change? There's so much at stake here for Russia.
There has been such an extraordinary groundswell of response in Sudan. And those we're speaking to in the civilian movement and the pro-democracy movement, despite the threats, have been so inspired by the popular response to this. So people are hopeful, and I'm hopeful for them.
CNN chief international investigative correspondent Nima El-Bagir on the story she broke about Russia's illegal profiteering off Sudanese gold. Nima, we have always appreciated your reporting. Best to you. Be safe. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. Take care.
In Kentucky today, rescue and recovery efforts continue after last week's catastrophic flash floods. At least 37 people have died, dozens more are still missing, and more than 1,300 rescues have taken place. Governor Andy Beshear spoke this morning.
It's going to take years to rebuild. People left with absolutely nothing. Homes that we don't know where they are, just entirely gone.
The Salvation Army has teams on the ground in eastern Kentucky, delivering meals and support to survivors and relief workers. The group's divisional commander for Tennessee and Kentucky is Major Thomas Loudon. Major, welcome.
Thank you so much, Scott. It's a privilege to be with you today. Thanks for having me.
What is the situation for your team getting around eastern Kentucky today? I understand more rain came yesterday and a lot of roads and bridges are still out.
That's correct. Right now, our teams are positioning themselves around the impacted area. We have five of our mobile feeding units that have been canvassing the area. Local authorities have been asking for us to come in with things like cleanup kits that include mops and buckets and gloves and disinfectant and bleach and those sort of things, and much needed food and drinking water. And our teams are encountering incredible devastation.
What do the roads look like?
Many of the roads are strangely passable until you get to where the water has breached the road. Some of our units have had to turn around and find new ways into areas which are limited. The terrain is quite challenging.
And I gather that means it's not just hard for your team members to get to the people, the needy people there, but it's that much harder for the people there to get to you and your mobile stations.
That is true. People have limited mobility right now, particularly where the floods have overtaken their homes and their modes of transportation, as well as the roadways. Getting relief like the Salvation Army to them is going to be a continued challenge, particularly in light of the recent rains of last night and the potential for increased flooding today.
How do you plan for that? You mentioned, right, the rain and more potential flash flooding coming Wednesday and Thursday. The forecast in parts of eastern Kentucky is going to feel like 100 degrees or hotter in some areas. Mm-hmm. How does your team kind of plan for these scenarios?
We have a lot of experience, unfortunately, a lot of experience in responding to disasters. And one of the lessons we have learned from all of the disasters is there are no two alike. We have people who have experience in redirecting themselves and coming up with plans on the fly. For instance, one of our resources is a mobile feeding unit that's really a kitchen on wheels. It's a large unit. It's not a unit that we would want to be driving through the hills and the valleys of eastern Kentucky. Mm-hmm. So we position it at high ground and safe areas. And then we use roving units that can respond quickly to either changing need or conditions.
Hmm. At the same time, Tom Loudon, you know, even as you and your team are professionals in this business, you know how awful this is. At least 37 dead. We're reading about four siblings under the age of eight. We're reading about a 30-year-old coal miner who went into the waters, drove into the waters to try to rescue his family. I mean, awful human tragedy. How does this affect the humans on your team? How does this affect you?
It leaves a lasting impression. Flooding is one of those disasters that is oftentimes underestimated, and you don't know the lasting impacts. It's not just a property loss. It's the loss of life, and that impacts everybody. The communities in eastern Kentucky are so close-knit. They're small and very close-knit communities, and the loss of one life impacts most likely the entire community. And so the Salvation Army is trained in spiritual and emotional care, and we will be alongside our people in eastern Kentucky for as long as need be. And then for our own workers, we provide a system of debriefing, of counseling, of loving care, tender loving care for our workers as they come off the front lines. So you're exactly right. There's so much impact that comes from disasters, and floods are very different from all the other disasters. It leaves a very long-lasting impression upon the survivors.
Major Thomas Loudon is Divisional Commander for Kentucky and Tennessee of the Salvation Army. Major Loudon, thanks for your time, and best to you and your team.
Thank you so much, Scott. God bless you. I appreciate you and all of your listeners.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now.